This is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells.
Our guest is Mark Lewis, a neuroscientist and an addict, or should we say a former addict. And he's written a book, The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. Lewis argues that point through some hard science and through his experience and the experience of other addicts.
This is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The 46th annual Park City Kimball Arts Festival happens July 31st through August 2nd. It's also the Kimball's largest fundraiser of the year. Don't forget to pick up your access passes for Park Avenue and Sweet Alley from the Kimball Arts Center. Locals Night, Friday, July 31st, is free to Summit County residents. Bring a valid ID to designated gates and get in for free. Details at parkcitykimballartsfestival.org. The Kimball Arts Center is a proud supporter of KPCW and a local nonprofit organization.
American Roots on KPCW is proudly supported by Donna Van Buren of Greater Park City Properties, managing HOAs in Park City, Canyons, and Deer Valley for 30 years. Greater Park City Properties can be reached at hoa@greaterparkcityproperties.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Our guest, Alberto Manguel, says that curiosity has been seen throughout the ages as the impulse that drives our knowledge forward and the temptation that leads us towards dangerous and forbidden waters. Without curiosity, he says, we are nothing. But what inspires curiosity, and how do we maintain it and foster it? And should we ask the big questions or the underlying questions? Manguel, in his book titled Curiosity, takes us on a ride through some of the great curious beings in history and also takes us through his drive to be curious. Alberto Manguel, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And, you know, in your book somewhere, you talk about as children, we're always asking that question, why? And then as adults, it kind of transforms, but even intensifies, which I thought was an interesting point because I think that some of us lose our curiosity. But you obviously are not someone who has experienced that one iota.
But certainly our experience is, In our societies, generally, that curiosity should not be encouraged. It's bad manners. It's considered prurient. It's associated with gossip and with forbidden things. So I think that in most cases, our education system, instead of encouraging curiosity in children, which is their natural impulse, stifles that curiosity, wants them to follow certain norms. And especially in our time, we tend to label the curiosity of children as a hyperactive syndrome or a lack of attention, an attention deficit illness, instead of considering what makes the child lose concentration in what the teacher is saying. Maybe the teacher is boring. Maybe there are more interesting things happening outside the window.
Absolutely. It is the age-old question of education, especially in the large public education systems that we have, how to put more creativity in and how to break the rote model. I'm wondering, well, you tell the story of, I think you're young and you're in Buenos Aires and you're wandering through this neighborhood. And this is kind of where you first acknowledge your own curiosity. Tell that story.
I had, as most of us, a daily route to go to school, and then one day I decided to break that. And wander through parts of the neighborhood that were unfamiliar to me. And what I realized was that what was driving me was the impulse of curiosity, but not for a certain purpose. That is to say, I was curious about the world. What would it reveal to me when I turned a corner with which I wasn't familiar? What was behind a shut door? And this is the impulse that drives us beyond the horizon, but at the same time sets limits. That is to say, we encourage questions that allow us to discover what is hidden, but at the same time we repress those questions in whatever terms our society fixes. In the Middle Ages, for instance, it was in religious terms, and somebody like Thomas Aquinas determines that curiosity can be perverted in a number of ways, well, in four particular ways. Either by turning us into proud creatures, proud of our impulse to seek. Secondly, by taking our attention towards lesser matters, and this is where the question of prurient curiosity and gossip comes in. Third, when we question the world we seek to know without taking into account what Aquinas calls the creator, but that I, for instance, as an unbeliever, would term the general context of the universe. We ask a question in a particular context without taking into account that this context exists in the larger context of space-time. And a fourth, that we have to recognize the limits of our own intelligence. We are all intelligent beings, but some more than others, and sometimes we require specialists, as most of the guests on your program, who will explain to us the object of our curiosity.
Right. Alberto, a couple minutes ago when you were talking, the phone conversation sort of, you know, we had trouble with it. It was modulating out. So it sounds a little better, but if there's anything that you can do to fix the sound, that would be great. I don't know if there's anything
you
can do.
Oh, dear. No, I have this phone that usually works. I'm sorry that it isn't working now.
Oh, no, it's working. It's just that you keep cutting out, but that's okay. We'll do the best we can with it.
I'll give brief answers if that helps.
Okay. You have quite a fascination with Dante's Inferno, and there's a lot of...
Dante's Commedia. Let's not limit it to the Inferno.
Okay, absolutely. And there's a number of interpretations of those works. Are you one of the interpreters of that, where you have written your own interpretation of all of that?
Every reader reads the Commedia in a different way, of course, because as with great works of art, we interpret them according to our experience. But, of course, we have to base our reading on the reading of scholars who will explain to us the facts that build up the piece. Who are the characters? What is the context of the religious dogma, and so on? But the Commedia can be read as an adventure story, as the exploration of one man driven by the curiosity that makes him ask, "Who am I?"
Right. And in Dante's Inferno, the people in hell certainly know why they were there, and they can all recite why they were there. And in your book, you contrast that with the victims of Auschwitz, who were in a living hell, but they didn't know why they were there.
In Auschwitz, there is an anecdote that I mention in the book, told by the great Italian writer Primo Levi, who was an inmate in Auschwitz. And at one point, Levi and certain other prisoners are standing freezing in one large hall, and they are dying of thirst. And outside is an icicle. And Levi puts his arm out of the window and grabs the icicle to suck on the ice and quench a little his thirst. And the guard takes a baton and hits Levi on the hand to have him drop the icicle. And Levi says in broken German, "Warum? Why?" And the guard answers, "Here is no why. Here is kein Warum." And that is the huge difference between Dante's Inferno and Auschwitz. In Auschwitz, there isn't a why. And in the Inferno, there is always a reason for the punishment. Dante believed, according to the Christian dogma, that we construct our own hells and our own heavens, that what we do in life establishes our rewards and our punishments.
Alberto, I have to admit something to you, and that is I have not read Dante's Commedia or Inferno except for passages here and there when I was in graduate school, and I felt it very daunting. So I would like for you to convince me or maybe direct me on how you might attempt those. And John was just saying he has it in his bookshelf as well and hasn't attempted it. how you might attempt it through this filter of or paradigm of curiosity. You know, if you think of Dante as being so curious, how might we attempt it?
I would say, well, first of all, I will admit that I hadn't read the Commedia up to 15 years ago. That was my first reading of the Commedia. And why do we find it so hard to admit that we haven't read all the great books in the world? No one has. And that there is a point where we discover a certain book and make it ours or not, or we reject it. Mm-hmm. Tolstoy thought that King Lear was an awful book. And we have to accept that books are very patient and they will wait for us until we are ready. So if you are ready for the Commedia, well, first of all, don't limit yourself to the Inferno. The Commedia consists of three parts: Inferno, Purgatory, and Paradise. And the voyage is through these three realms. And if you read the Commedia not as a work coming out of the Christian dogma written in the early 4th century, but as a sort of imaginative travelogue, something like the Hobbit's journey, if you will, where a main character who speaks to us, to the readers, tells us about these extraordinary adventures, meeting extraordinary characters, and also everyday characters, because these are people that Dante knew in his youth or heard about in the historical context of his society, or also read in books these characters that he read in, for instance, Virgil Aeneid, are very real to him, so he encounters them. And if we leave aside the scholarly apparatus, I think that we can read the Commedia as one of the most extraordinary adventure stories ever written.
I like that. A travelogue. I'll keep that in mind as I attempt it. Our guest is Alberto Manguel. He's the author of the book Curiosity. And Alberto, I believe you have made a lot of your living through being a translator for many, many years. How many languages do you operate in? Do you translate?
Well, I speak five languages and read six, but I have translated several books in my youth. But translating is, I think, the highest level of reading. A translator needs to go deeply into a book, take it apart, and rebuild it with other tools. So he has to, or she has to, know more about the book than the author herself. Hmm. And that is an effort that I no longer make, because I realize that to translate a book fully, you need as much effort and time as to write your own book. And so now, with the years that I have left, I think I want to write rather than the higher task of translating.
Mm.
Let's talk about technology. How do you believe technology has changed curiosity?
If by technology you mean the system that enables us to use certain tools, I think that ever since the discovery of fire or the wheel or the first weapons, we have used technology to allow us to explore certain areas into which our curiosity takes us, so that we can understand more of the world around us and survive in that world. It was easier to survive in the world of prehistory after the discovery of fire than before. It allowed us to have light for many more hours, to cook food, to keep dangerous animals away, and so on. So what we, I think, need to remember is that every technology has its vocabulary and its uses and its qualities. And if a technology betrays us, it is not that the technology betrays us, but that we use it badly. It is not the fault of a knife that we commit a murder with a knife instead of slicing bread. And what I find today is, because the technology that we call new, and isn't new, of course, the electronic technology, my grandchildren think that it is as old as the ox-driven cart might be for us, that technology is suited for certain purposes. And if we want to use it for other purposes and we find it frustrating, it's not the fault of that technology, but ours.
That's a really interesting response. Before we let you go, I just want to ask you, I know you were born in Argentina, you lived in Canada for some time, and you have this
house.
You have this house in France where you have a 30,000 volume library. I just have to know, when you go into that library, what do? Just revisit a book that you haven't read in a while? Do you just stare fondly at the books? How do you operate in your library?
In all those ways, I think that with age comes a desire for revisiting old friends and less of an urge to discover new things. Because as with old friends, the conversation leads you into further depth and further discoveries without having to deal with the superficial value of surprise. So more and more what I do is reread. I read Dante a canto every morning, and I have been on that journey very many times, but every time I start it again, it is almost as if I were starting a new journey because of the richness of the book. As with an old friend, you discover new things constantly.
All right. Well, Alberto Mangel is the author of the book Curiosity, and we thank you so much for joining us today. And we're going home. We're going to grab that. John's going to grab Dante's Inferno, and who knows, maybe I'll pick it up someday. Alberto, thank you.
I would suggest that you read a literal translation like Singleton's.
Okay.
Which is, I think, the best.
Singleton. All right. Will do. Alberto, thanks
right,
for your time.
Thank you.
Take care. Wow. Hey, how often do you reread books? I'm curious about this because I never do, and yet because I figure there's so many books out there that I haven't yet gotten to, why I can't reread them. Do you reread them a lot?
Every once in a while, but mostly what I might do is I may look for a particular passage, within a book. So I'll take notes on certain things, and I want to go back and reread them.
Right. And I always wonder if I were to reread a book that impacted me very heavily at a certain point in my life, would it do the same at a different stage? It seems like the books that I read in my 20s seemed to shape so much and mold the way I thought. And I wonder if it would be the same if I went back.
Yeah, I remember in high school reading Of Mice and Men, Steinbeck's, and I was just found the book riveting. It just really woke me up or something. I don't know what happened, but then when I was maybe a couple years later, I saw it on the stage. And recently at the Pioneer Theater last year, I saw it again, and it had been many, many years. And it was still riveting to me.
It was.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, that was an interesting conversation with Alberto Mangel. Not a typical one we have here on Cool Science Radio, but curiosity and science are linked somehow. And we'll be right back to welcome our next guest and to talk about our cool story for today, which is, well, we'll get to that in the end of the hour, but a dating website that helps married people cheat. Hit
has,
by hackers
has
last
been
week.
Hacked.
And wonder why that is. Stay with us to find out. We'll be right back.
The National Ability Center is a nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter. This August 22nd, hit the pavement to benefit the National Ability Center during the Summit Challenge. This fully supported 18, 52, or 102-mile road ride follows many of the same routes as Tour de Utah and welcomes riders of all abilities. Riders with a disability are invited to participate at no cost. Early bird registration ends July 31st, so visit summitchallenge100.org.
Singer-composer bassist Esperanza Spalding brings her newest project, Emily's D-Plus Evolution, to the St. Regis Big Stars Bright Nights series on July 30th. The Grammy-winning Spalding shares the bill with vocalist-composer Perla Battaglia and singer-songwriter Anna Wilson. Expect rock, jazz, folk, funk, scat, and more at Deer Valley's Outdoor Amphitheater at 7 p.m. For tickets, call 655-3114. Brought to you by the not-for-profit Park City Institute, educating, entertaining, and illuminating since 1998, a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Alberto Mangel, who wrote the book Curiosity. And now we're going to be talking about addiction. It's a disease, right? Well, at least that's what we've been told. And there's a genetic predisposition towards addiction. Well, our next guest, Mark Lewis, who is a neuroscientist and former addict, tells us that science what science shows us is not necessarily true, and that addiction isn't a disease. And he's written a book, The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. He says the disease model of addiction is wrong and that it stymies the path to recovery. Instead, Lewis shows how recovery can be more easily achieved and shows with science that addiction is an unintended consequence of the brain doing what it's supposed to do, which is seeking pleasure and relief in a world that's, well, maybe not cooperating. Mark Lewis, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I think about disease and you know, just grab a couple, lung disease, you might be predisposed towards it, but if you smoke cigarettes, that might encourage it, or if you, if genetically you have a history of heart disease in your family, but you don't eat very well, and you don't exercise, and you're under a tremendous amount of stress, that really encourages it. So it seems that almost all of these diseases are somewhat of a choice as we encourage these addictions or these diseases. Is that true?
That's a loaded question. That one's supposed to come at the end.
Okay.
And in a way, that's a good way of trying to coordinate the two sides of the argument because. Yeah, when I say addiction is not a disease, I am saying that there is some choice involved. But I don't think it's a simple choice, and I don't think it's necessarily a rational choice because there's a long, slow process of learning, which can be quite insidious. And when I say addiction is not a disease, I don't mean to say that it's not serious, because it very often is. Mm-hmm. And I also don't say that we shouldn't listen to the science. I think we should take a better look at the science. The neuroscience of addiction, which does indeed show that there are brain changes that correspond to addiction. But I think if we look at those findings in more detail, we see that those changes are not permanent. They're changes in a plastic brain, in a brain that is kind of like plasticine or Play-Doh, in the sense that it's designed to continue to change itself. Unlike Play-Doh, it doesn't harden in the sun. It keeps on being changeable. So there's a whole lot of middle ground between the idea of a changing brain and the medical notion of a disease.
Yeah, and we're learning so much more about the brain every year. It seems like just in the last 10 years, so many things have come out. One of the things that you mentioned in the book, which I found absolutely fascinating, was that as an addict progresses through his or her addiction, the gray matter in the prefrontal cortex, where you have elements of self-control, they decline by as much as 20%, and that's measured. It's empirical data. They can actually quantify that. And then, if the addict is able to abstain from their addiction over a period of time, and as few as 4, 5, 6 months of abstinence, it increases not only again to its baseline where it was when it, you know, before the addictive behavior started, but it actually increases as the addict starts to, and for, I'm trying to think of the words for this.
Continue to abstain.
Yeah.
If you continue to abstain past a certain period of time, you get increased growth, and then you get gray matter volume or gray matter density in the same areas that showed the depletion, and you say it goes beyond baseline.
Is that coping strategies, or that?
Well, yeah, that's what I think. This is one study. It's a very well conducted study, and there are others that show similar things. But we should always be a little bit cautious in interpreting these studies. They're very, very complicated and hard to do. And the brain measures themselves, although you're right, they're very sophisticated. They rely on number crunching. So just retain a grain of caution. But yeah, I think it is about coping strategies. When people abstain, when they learn to control their their cravings, their urgings, and their when they learn to reverse their habits and change their perspective and hold off their pursuit of rewards, then that takes effort. That's a skill that you learn, and
right.
Like any skill that you practice, it builds up synaptic pathways. It builds up gray matter in the cortex. The more you practice, the more it builds those connections and those networks. And so, yeah, I think that's why it goes beyond the original baseline.
Right. And it appears to me, I mean, in your book you have hard science, and you also have these vignettes, these five stories of addicts, which are heartbreaking stories. In those five addicts and in addicts that I have met and that I know, one of the common elements is tremendous guilt that they have.
Yeah.
I was curious, as they study the prefrontal cortex, does guilt have any role in the shrinkage or in once the addict abstains and is losing that guilt in the rebuilding of the prefrontal cortex? Does mm-hmm. guilt play a role?
That's another really interesting question. I've had quite a number of interviews. I think you're asking some of the hardest questions so far. People talk mostly about shame and stigma in relation to addiction. And so we think of that in terms of being denigrated or scorned by others, and then we internalize that, and you know, we basically indulge in self-hatred, self-blame, self-disgust, and that's a pretty awful state to be in. Well, guilt is a similar emotion, but it's not exactly the same. Guilt is a bit of a higher order emotion in which you actually feel that you can feel responsible for other people's suffering or harm to other people. So what would that do then? That would possibly indeed shut down, if you feel ongoing guilt or shame, it might shut down your attempt to go out into the world, to meet other people, even to change yourself. Even the motive to become a better person could get paralyzed or frozen by excessive guilt or shame. So it's an interesting concept. I haven't thought about it in that way exactly. And I should mention, the changes that you mentioned in the prefrontal cortex, yes, there's some evidence that there's a loss of some synapses in some areas. But there's a lot of other changes in the brain. And especially in this region called the striatum, which is right in the middle of the cortex, it's a bit of a more primitive area in charge of goal pursuit and desire and goal seeking. And that region also gets rewired. It doesn't lose gray matter. It just gets more tuned to particular rewards, a narrower, smaller set of rewards, which could be drugs or booze or gambling or sex or whatever it is. It looks the same across addictions. Those changes in the striatum look pretty much the same. And one way to think about that is to say that the striatum is losing its connectivity to the prefrontal cortex. The pathways between these two systems, the older desire system and the more sophisticated thinking system, the pathways between those two systems are starting, it's like they're going down for repairs or something. The road is being shut down from a four-lane highway to a two-lane road. And as we're saying, that may be a temporary situation based on changes in behavior and sticking to very routine behaviors without being able to think about it and supervise it in a more deliberate way. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, it does.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Mark Lewis. He's the author of the book, The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. And Mark, I'm wondering, you know, we know so much more now, as you were saying, about the malleability or the plasticity of the brain, and also about the human genome and how we can sort of rechart the path of our genome based on our behaviors. But it also kind of, I'm kind of curious on the flip side of it. I noticed in at least a couple of the vignettes or the examples that you gave, the anecdotes, there were people who seemed as though they had no predisposition to addiction. And yet, like right. In the case of Brian, who at age 32 suddenly becomes a meth addict in a very big, bad way. Talk about that, because it seems like there are always these signs of addictive behavior, but not in some of these people.
Yeah. John, I realize I didn't. It's John, right?
Yes.
Is it John?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I realize I didn't answer your first question about the genetic predispositions. So I guess we'll get back to that now.
Okay.
Is that okay? that's what you're asking. Is it Lynn? Is that the other
Lynn? Yes.
That I'm speaking to?
Yes.
Okay. So yes, there are genetic links, but they're complicated. There's no addiction gene. There's no particular cluster of genes that directly disposes toward addiction. Rather, it's a combination of factors. So, for example, one factor would possibly be impulsive personality, an impulsive personality style. So that's a personality trait. So it's got a certain genetic loading. Mm-hmm. And if you are that way, you're probably going to reach for things and be more troublesome as a little kid and have more adventures and get in more trouble. And then when you hit the adolescent years, you're probably going to be more likely to experiment with drugs and less likely to put off exciting possibilities. So that would be a possible genetic carrier. But that would only account for a very small percentage of the correlation from one generation to the next. So you have to combine that with other factors. Well, what else? Frustration tolerance, maybe sensitivity to rejection, maybe sensitivity to guilt and blame, as we were talking about, and the capacity to self-regulate. Everyone has a kind of implicit capacity to control and regulate their own emotions. And when you start to talk about those more complex characteristics, they're not just genetic. They're very much determined by child rearing, by environmental factors, by how you brought up, by who you hang around with as a kid. There are all these environmental factors that I stress in my book more than genetic factors. You could look at both. I think the environmental factors are, in a way, more interesting. And it's also that's where we can have more impact in our treatment policy, because that's where we can actually help change people's lives in such a way that they will be less vulnerable to addiction.
Right. So that's why you say, talk a little bit, if you would, about how the current disease model stymies our recovery. Is it just because it becomes this accepted thing? Well, I'm an addict and there's really no way out of this?
And you're asking, what are you asking about the word recovery?
About why you theorize or why you're saying that the current model, the disease model, kind of holds us up in recovery because... And I'm wondering why that is. Is it because we just come to accept that this is a genetic marker and there's nothing we can do about it?
The idea, the official definition, and this comes from the NIH, National Institutes of Health, and especially NIDA, the National Institute of Drug Abuse. That's kind of like the golden circle of U.S. policy and research money for studying addiction. Well, their official definition is that addiction is chronic brain disease. And the word chronic is really strongly highlighted in their literature and their websites and their talks and so forth. And I'm Laura Volko, is a well-known spokesperson. So chronic means chronic. It means that you're not going to get better. And that means that they consider the changes that are going on in the brain to be, in some sense, permanent. And I just don't think that the research shows that at all. The study that you mentioned, John, is one example. But there's been a whole lot of recent work on neuroplasticity, which I think you're pointing out then for a moment. Neuroplasticity is a way of looking at the brain as an organ which continues to change based on environmental changes and based on self-modifications, practice, exercise, skills. We see people getting better, whether their learning is disabled, whether they have ADHD, a whole bunch of other psychological issues and learning problems can be improved when people practice doing something in a different way. And the same thing happens with addiction, I say. And therefore, the brain has to be changing, because if it wasn't changing, the behavior wouldn't change. So, yeah, the disease model is it's kind of fatalistic. If you got the disease, then you're not going to get better. Yes, you can learn to control it. You take these medications. You make sure you never drink again or never do this again or never do that again. And if you do all of that, well, then you're going to be in control of the disease. But that's kind of a delicate, fragile situation for a lot of people, probably because for all kinds of reasons, they don't take their antibiotics or they don't take their Naloxone or they don't take their Suboxone or they trade it in for something else or... It's pretty hard for some people to follow that regimen, and then they relapse.
Mark, so one of the takeaways from all of this is that by taking a look at your... Excuse me?
Okay, go on.
One of the takeaways is that through counseling, you can go back and find areas in your life that maybe not, you know, are not resolved. And you talk about this in your own alcohol addiction. Can you talk about that?
For me, it was opiates, actually.
Okay.
That was my Achilles heel. So was, I'm losing track of your question.
Your own experience.
And what are you asking?
Your own experience in tackling your addiction and being able to break yourself away and be clean. And what was required on your part to make that happen? I mean, you were an active participant in becoming able to abstain from the opiates.
Yeah, right. I see. Yeah, I guess the reason I was thrown off is because I didn't have counseling, and I think counseling can be very helpful for a lot of people. I did it in a kind of strange way. I did it more on my own through meditation and. Some mindfulness practice that I learned, you know, on the fly from different groups and so on. It also, for me, it was partly a process of growing up, which I think is the case for a lot of addicts. A lot of addictions end spontaneously, what they call spontaneous recovery, in people's 30s, so they can go through their 20s and be in pretty rough shape, and then the late 20s and early 30s, they're looking at their lives in a different way, and they're saying, this is really real shit. I really don't want to live like this anymore. And the aversiveness of the addiction overrides the attraction. For me, that was a big part of it, being highly averse. And even though the attraction didn't go away, it was kind of turned by this feeling of repulsion. So between that and taking myself in hand, growing up, doing every day, I managed to quit after quite a few efforts. One of them actually worked. And I didn't know for sure that it had worked until I could look back months later, of course, and say, well, it's working. I'm doing it.
Yeah, and once again, for our listeners, the book is The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. We're speaking with Mark Lewis, who's written this fascinating book. There's really hard science in it, but a good science, not hard to understand, but good science. But it's also, there are five stories, and one of your stories is titled Johnny Needs a Drink. And this gentleman, Johnny, I mean, reading the story, this guy had spiraled down, and his friends, his work, his career, I mean, everything was in trouble. And he woke up and every morning, and he would start drinking heavily, and his days didn't last very long because he'd just pass out, I guess, and he was able to turn this whole thing around, and a lot of it had to do with his ability to get a hold of himself. I mean, he got into counseling, and he certainly got into a detox. But what do you think the key was for him?
I think it was all of those factors. He had gotten to, as you said, a severe point. His life was absolutely intolerable, and it was hell. And he was on the verge of suicide. Of the five people that I described, I think his story is in some ways the most appalling.
And, yes, I would agree.
Right? Yeah. It's pretty miserable stuff. So I guess he came to a fork in the road where he felt he absolutely had to change, and he did get himself into counseling. He first went to a detox. It was a 30-day detox. Good start, but as most of us know, these residential 30-day residential programs are simply not enough. People leave those programs, and 8 or 9 times out of 10, they're back in 6 months. The result is a revolving door. So, but when he got out of his detox, he immediately went to see an individual counselor, psychiatrist, who worked with him for a while, sent him off to another counselor, and so that started happening. He also started doing some yoga, some got massage. I mean, he just, you know, it was like a shotgun effect. He tried many different things at the same time, and he wanted bad enough to stop. I think that's actually a critical factor that we often, it's the elephant in the living room. This wanting to stop is really important because addiction is powerful, and it's magnetic. It's a field that you get into, and it gets hard to get out of. I'm certainly not disputing that. But when people want to get out very badly, then they hitch that engine of desire, the striatum that I was talking about, to a different set of goals. And it's kind of like, I think, kind of like an electric arc that suddenly arcs to a different location. The static electricity can arc to a new location. That engine of desire arcs onto a new set of goals. And he really worked hard and needed to work hard and needed to change his life. And he did through these multiple methods.
Mm. Mark, I'm wondering, you distinguish between physical addiction and psychological addiction. And I wanted to ask you, what is the most addictive substance? Maybe if they would be different, physically addictive substance and psychologically addictive substance.
They certainly are not fully correlated. You can be strongly psychologically addicted to something that is not physically addicted. And cocaine is a good example of that. The cocaine has no withdrawal symptoms. You probably feel miserable for about 3 or 4 days, and then that's it as far as the physical part. But the psychological part is this ongoing craving. Wouldn't it be nice just one more time? I would really like to feel that feeling again. So as far as the most physically addicting substances, opiates, heroin, for example. I mean, those are the obvious ones. Alcohol is not physically addictive in the normal sense, but when people drink very heavily, do go through a period of in which their bodies are essentially rebounding, and they can be very stressful symptoms for a week or 10 days. But even for Johnny, that period is over in a week. And then there are other non-substances that are so incredibly compelling that people destroy their lives without having to ingest anything. Gambling is probably the best example.
Gambling.
Right. People get seriously into gambling and really, you know, sell everything they own and get deeply into debt and just destroy their lives. So there's a psychological addiction with obviously no physical counterpart.
Mm. I don't know if you have kids. Do you have kids?
I do.
Okay. Yes. What one thing would you tell your kids, never, ever, ever do this?
Yeah. Okay. So besides heroin and cocaine, there's also crack and methamphetamine. And I think crack, meth, and heroin are by far the most destructive drugs, most dangerous drugs. For slightly different reasons, but again, methamphetamine is not physically addictive in a normal sense, but it's strongly psychologically addictive, and people can stay on it for, well, a long, long time. And it's also one of the few drugs that has directly destructive effects on the body and the nervous system. Probably seen long-term meth addicts and looked at their rotting teeth and the sores on their face and. They're just a mess. So for my kids, I would say, I have said, I've got kids of two generations. One's in her late 20s, and I've got a set of twins now who are 9. I don't talk to them about drugs yet, but for my daughter, I have said to her, if you ever try heroin, crack, or methamphetamine, I'm going to chain you to the radiator. And however, there are other drugs that if you try, for example, mushrooms and so forth, and pot and other things like that, you know, I don't think that that's going to be a terribly dangerous to do. I think that's called exploration. Radically different drugs.
Mm, thank you for that.
Mark Lewis, who has written The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. We want to thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, and best of luck with your book. It was fascinating.
Great. Thanks a lot for talking about it.
Yeah. Well, this is Cool Science Radio. We shall return right after these messages, and when we do, we have a fascinating, interesting, cool science story for you.
Hi, this is Katie Wang, Executive Director of the Park City Film Series. We're taking a break from our regular programming for the summer, but we will be back in September at the now fully digital Jim Santee Auditorium in the Park City Library Building. We've got great events planned for the fall and some special events this summer, too. So like us on Facebook or check out our website at parkcityfilmseries.org to stay in the loop. Park City Film Series is a nonprofit organization and supporter of KPCW.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. Okay, how about that dating website? What is it called? Ashley Madison's?
Yeah.
Of all things to be called. But it's a cheater website. It helps married people cheat. So you can go online, you put all this highly classified information in there, explicit pictures, so on and so forth. Well, some would say karmic justice, but it got hacked.
And the CEO says that he's got 36 or 37 million customers who have all filled their profiles out with not only personal information on who they are, but maybe some, interesting photos and
incriminating
and talking about fantasies and other things. What I want to know is I don't think anything's come out yet on whether blackmail's involved or if it's a morality play. Probably blackmail, but it could be a morality play. You never know. It's a crazy world. What do you think, Lynn?
Well, I think if you're a hacker, you've got some issues with morality to begin with. However, these hackers, they call themselves the Impact Team, have demanded that the site go offline or else they threaten to disclose these 37 million profiles to the world.
Well, it might be a morality play.
Well, it might be, but it's also, they have something against Ashley Madison. Perhaps it's a disgruntled former worker, because Ashley Madison sells back or says they will erase a user's profile and data for a fee, and they collect about $1 million a year doing this. Oh, well, you put your profile up, but now you've decided you don't want to be a cheater anymore. For a small fee, we can erase all of it. So very interesting. We'll see. We'll follow this story.
Yeah, and just one more short thing. Well, small thing. Their motto is "Life is short, have an affair." I mean, it's just incredible, isn't it?
It really is. Okay, we want to thank our underwriters, a new one, the Utah Natural History Museum, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Nexus IT, and Peak Art and Frame.